The Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. But we're very excited about finding out when you were going to be back on the air again. And
I'm really flattered. I'll do my best.
So we can't do any better than getting you on the first show the next week. So, in fact, I have a friend out in California by the name of John that I want to give a shout out to. He specifically requested that you get back here as soon as possible. So this goes out to John. So. With that said, I sort of gave an overview of what we talked about. Of course, we went into a lot of detail about some inventions and these associations that these other scientists and technicians and inventors had with Nikola Tesla. But you wanted to sort of pick up from there and complete the story so that we understand your background.
Well, what I would like to do is I'd like to touch on one of the most influential guys from the period of my life when I was really beginning to understand how complicated all this stuff was. And even though he was not a true scientist in the sense that he was a degreed individual working in a laboratory or a university, this gentleman was responsible for mentoring me in ways that I probably couldn't have received from any college anywhere, and gave me an enormous amount of freedom and support and direction, which I'll always be grateful for. And I'm referring to Mr. Gene Carini, who I met roundaboutly as a result of my association with Dominic Lucchesi. Mm-hmm. I think we closed last week mentioning the fact that at the tender age of 19, and I might add, in opposition to his major stockholders, he was kind enough to hire me as director of research and development for his little electric car company up in Connecticut, called Energy Systems Incorporated. And that was quite an experience, Don.
Yeah, you had mentioned that, yes. So you're bringing us up to date now as to where we were in that history. That's quite the young age to be handling such a responsible position. You must have been very qualified for that.
Well, I had a very interesting background, even at that age, as you already know. And a lot of the summer jobs that I had had really helped to mold me into the type of individual that they were looking for, or at least that Gene was looking for. I was already a machinist at that age. I had been taught lathe and millwork by a gentleman in Jersey City who I used to work for part-time. I had already had two jobs by this time, drawing professional blueprints, and I had taken technical drawing in high school, so that all of that was very helpful. And of course, I had been tinkering with electronics all my life. So when you put all those three things together, and couple that with the fact that I'm endowed with an exceptionally rich imagination, Gene was very enamored with me, and he felt I could do the job. So even though some of his stockholders didn't like the idea, he insisted that they hire me, and they did.
Uh-huh. Did you lobby for this position, Jim, or was it that he saw this potential in you and he offered it?
He offered it. As a matter of fact, it was really kind of interesting because I went up to see him without any forewarning of what he was really doing or the fact that he was looking for someone. From my point of view, the things that I had heard about him were extremely exciting, And so I was very compelled to dig into this in more detail. And a friend of mine drove up with me to Connecticut, and we met Gene. And during the course of that visit, he went through an enormous questionnaire asking me all kinds of questions, which I assumed was out of curiosity, because after all, we didn't know one another. And then I asked him a battery of questions for similar reasons. And by the end of the day, when he took me down and showed me his car barn, as he used to call it, in which he had five electric vehicles, I was already flying quite high. And I don't think I could have been any more excited when he turned around and said, you know, he said, if you're interested, I'd love to have you work with me. And I said, really? In what capacity? And he said, well, he said, I'm the president of the company. How would you like to be director of research and development? And, you know, my knees almost went out from under me. It was very flattering. It really was.
Yeah, I'm sure. You were 19 then, right? You said.
Yeah, so, I was 19. And so really what I wound up doing was delaying my return to college, and I worked with Gene for, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was about 10 or 11 months. I know it was just shy of a year. And I moved up to Connecticut, and one of the first things I started doing for him was building models and making tests on these models. And I was quite flabbergasted that he had never done this before. His approach had been just go ahead and build full-scale cars, which is okay, but it's a very expensive way to proceed, especially when you don't know how to optimize the system you're endeavoring to develop. So I started off building benchtop models of his concept, and bought a fantastic little miniature dynamometer from a company up in Boston. And we used to use that to measure the overall efficiency of these devices. And it was the type of work, first of all, that I loved doing. And second of all, I was learning while I was being paid, which was extraordinary for me. And it just was one of the happiest, most rewarding times of my life, though. It really was.
Yeah. Now you mentioned a dynamometer. I have a general idea what that does, but for the sake of our listening audience, could you, in a sentence or two, describe what that device is like? Because you're talking about a device that measures the efficiency and the characteristics of a particular invention, something that's not even created yet. I mean, you have to invent something that you understand how the dynamometer works first, don't you? I'm just being
well. Actually, it wasn't too complicated. First of all, a dynamometer is basically there are different types, but basically a device which measures the torque and the RPM supplied to it by some kind of prime mover, and some more advanced dynamometers can actually supply a load as well. This one was very primitive, so it didn't supply a load. I supplied the load myself with a brake assembly. And basically what we were doing was connecting Gene's drive assembly to the input side of the dynamometer and using a watt meter to measure the power going into his unit and then measuring the mechanical power coming out with the dynamometer. And then by comparing the input to the output, we were getting an idea of what the overall efficiency was.
Okay.
And according to Gene's theory, the efficiency should have been enormous. But according to the instruments, it was terrible. And that was really the beginning of a very interesting personal thrust for understanding this device, because I kept working on it long after the company was disbanded, and it led me eventually to understand things about Tesla's work which are just not in the books, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, you know, my sort of humorous remark was really intended to suggest that possibly because this is an advanced concept being put to work, put to the test, that the test equipment itself was behind the technology. That's what I was leading or alluding to, let's say. And you're saying,
well,
in a sense, that was partially the case then.
Well, you can't really, unfortunately, with this type of investigatory work, you can't really figure out where you are without some kind of a baseline from which to judge your progress.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, instruments supply you with that.
Yes.
So if you, for instance, if you have a motor that you're testing, you want to first establish how efficient the motor is before you attach it to a load, and then you measure the output from the other side of the load, and that gives you an idea of what's happening between the motor and the load itself.
Yes.
If you hadn't established the motor's efficiency first, then you still wouldn't know where you were at with respect to the results.
Yes.
And that's what we were trying to do with Gene's invention.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't mean to belabor you with that question, but that gives the listeners an idea of what's going on, you know, how this is being tested. Because I know, that, and you know, that it's very significant in relation to some of your inventions.
Oh, well, thank God that I established the foundations of different types of mensuration rather early on, because I've used it all my life. And not only for my own stuff, but for, you know, very big companies that I've worked for. And without having those fundamentals well in hand, I doubt that I would have been recognized as a successful engineer in the domain of power, because that's really what it's all about. If you understand power and measurement, it puts you in a very interesting position in this type of field.
Okay. So now you worked for Carini for some 11 months, and then what happened?
Well, actually, toward the end of our association, there was a lot of internal turmoil in the company, and I won't go into it except to say that the investors were not pleased with the overall results of the electric car program, and they were looking for huge returns on their money in a very insignificant amount of time, which was very unrealistic. So while Gene was battling with those people, trying to get additional funds, and I was trying desperately to find some data to support his theories, which at that time, by the way, I did not yet realize were not his own. I only found out later on that, for the most part, he had gotten ideas from Carr during his association with Carr, and of course Carr in turn had taken the same ideas from Tesla. I was not aware of that stuff at this point in time. And so what happened at the very end was quite interesting. One day there was a mysterious phone call from this individual who he later identified for me as Warren Goetz. And I was in the lab when the call came through, and luckily we had two extensions in that room, and Gene motioned for me to pick up the phone, and so I overheard this incredible conversation between him and this stranger, in which this guy was describing this 32-foot flying saucer that they were building in a secret base in Michigan. And Gene started asking this guy all kinds of questions about utrons and lag magnets and crystals and magnetic pole configurations and all these various things. And the guy seemed to know all the answers. And I thought that was pretty astounding, because I had already figured that, having worked with Carr, that Gene was probably the only authority on building these paragravitic craft. And yet here was this other guy who I didn't know from Adam, and he was answering all the questions in a way that astounded Gene, and seemed to establish that he had a good deal of knowledge in this field.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened ultimately was, after the phone call ended, I had an extended conversation with Gene, and he told me that this guy was named Warren Getz, and he was up in the northern peninsula of Michigan in a little town of Detour. And apparently he had phoned Getz because a lady friend of his had heard about him at a meeting in Detroit and alerted Gene to his presence and given him the phone number, and Gene had called him previously and left word for him to call him back, something like that. And so I remembered all that information, and two or three nights after that phone call, the car barn was burned to the ground, and it was never really established who burned the building down, but all of Gene's full-size models were destroyed. And at that point, there was all kinds of lawsuits and everything else flying around, and so Gene told me that he was going back to Florida, and I had no choice but to go back to New Jersey, and so I went back to Jersey and got re-involved in school. But a few months later, that whole issue was just burning in my brain, and I decided to check the information in northern Michigan and see if I could locate this guy Getz. And sure enough, his number was listed. So I began calling the guy and talking to him, and he invited me to come up and visit him. After several conversations on the phone. And I will never forget, as long as I live, the feeling that was instilled in me on that trip. I mean, it was just something out of a sci-fi movie, Don. You just can't imagine the feelings that went through me as a young guy interested in all this borderline stuff and just on fire with passion to do something unusual.
I'm sorry. I was just going to ask you, are we talking Twilight Zone or something a little bit further out than that?
Well, you know, the thing about the Twilight Zone was that most of the concepts that were embedded in Rod Serling's stories were always arranged in such a way that the person watching the skit felt like part of them was in one world and part of them was in another world. And
yeah.
I think that's what made it so alluring. And that's exactly the kind of feeling that I had when I made this journey up to Michigan. We landed in Sault Ste. Marie, I think it was in November. It was bitterly cold. It was like 25, 30 below zero, and there was a light snow coming down. And we flew in on North Central Airlines, which I don't even think exists anymore. We rented a car, and by the time we drove the 60 miles or so from Sault Ste. Marie down to Detour and located this guy, it was already dark. And Warren was very cordial, invited us in. We sat down, had a cup of coffee, and talked for about an hour and a half with him. And then all of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, he says, "Well," he said, "I think that you're, I think you're the right kind of a person that I can show this, my work to." And he said, "I'll have my assistant take you down." So he picked up the phone and dialed a number. And within 10, 15 minutes, this older gentleman showed up in an old Willys Jeep with an open top on it. And we climbed into this Jeep, and drove down an old dirt road through the forest, and it was pitch dark. The stars were twinkling, and it was a light snow. And eventually we came out on the shores of Lake Huron on this particular bay, and there was this huge aircraft hangar. I don't remember the dimensions, but I'll guess that it was maybe something like 50 feet wide and 150 feet long, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy opened the security fence, and we went in, and he opened the door to the hangar in the front, pitch dark inside. And the first thing I noticed was the smell of epoxies. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And we're standing there in the dark, and the guy hits the switch, and it took a few minutes for these high-intensity lights to strike an arc and actually begin to light up. And as they began to light, my eyes became accustomed to the change in the darkness, and I began to perceive the outline of a huge shape. And by the time the lights were coming on, I realized I was standing in front of a flying saucer.
So
and I could literally feel the... What?
That's the outer limits now.
Oh, I'll tell you, I could literally feel the hair on the back of my head stand up, you know.
Outer limits.
It was a very, very incredible feeling. And I think what made it even more peculiar was the fact that everybody that was involved with this project treated it like it was, you know, a ho-hum, everyday type thing, you know. And it certainly wasn't that for me. it was really, really an incredible experience.
Well, I'm imagining you become conditioned watching that over a period of time, you know. You're seeing it being put together. That's what it is. It's no big shock. But for you to just walk in there and see it, of course, it would shock a lot of people. It might even shock the government.
Well, I'm sure probably it did.
Okay.
Anyway, to make a long story short, I became totally enamored with this other project, and since nothing had materialized from my association with Gene, except for my personal evolution, I made a decision, and the following summer, I actually moved up to Michigan. I bought a piece of property from Mr. Goetz, and I moved up to Michigan. I guess I was about 20 years old, or, yeah, 20, maybe pushing 21. And it was in the summer of 1969. And I moved up there on my birthday, of all things. And, of course, never having lived in that part of the country, I had the vaguest idea of what I was in for. I started building a cabin to live in around the end of August. And I barely had it closed in when winter struck. The first snow up there came about the middle of October. And I want to tell you, that first winter up there was unbelievable. I had no heat, no electricity, no job. I was driving a 1969 Mustang, which was the only thing that was reliable since it was a brand new car. And I was basically on my own with no knowledge of what the winters in the northern Michigan were like.
How I ever
survived, I don't know.
Yeah, it gets very cold. The animals up there will tell you that, you know. it gets cold, and the wind comes down from Alaska, you know, across Canada. And, I mean, it's bitter cold, so we get the picture, especially the people listening in Florida right now. They know, you know, what that's like. Just to imagine that. Okay, so,
well,
So you got settled up there, and then what happened your first winter now? You built your house, and
well, you had to find a job. It wasn't much of a house, I'll tell you that. But anyway, I managed to survive, and the following, well, actually, the first job I had, believe it or not, was in St. Ignace, Michigan, which was 60 miles away, and I was commuting back and forth to this job down in St. Ignace, which was very unhandy, I might add, but it was the only way to earn a living up there. And during that time period, of course, I started meeting local people. And I met this gentleman who had been an auto mechanic for many years, and he had worked on tugboats. And, of course, I had worked on tugboats. And so we hit up quite a nice friendship. And after a time, he invited me to set up a little shop in his in an old building that was on his property where he used to do custom engine work.
Mm-hmm.
And during the time that we were trying to establish this little shop, what happened was that, well, two things happened, actually. First of all, I began to have my suspicions about Mr. Goetz and that project because I began to learn a lot of things that surprised me. And one of them was that there was some kind of an association between Goetz and Carr. And, of course, I hadn't met Carr yet, so I didn't really understand what it was, but it made me very suspicious because I knew who Carr was at this point. And I was now beginning to wonder if Goetz's information was his own or if it was also something derived from Carr. But during that same period of time, I had news of an accident over on Drummond Island, and the electrical foreman who had been running the dolomite plant over there, which was owned by Bethlehem Steel, got killed in a snowmobile accident. And the word went out that they were looking for an electrical foreman. And so immediately I applied for the job. And I was very surprised when they actually accepted me for the position. So I actually wound up working for Bethlehem Steel for the next 7 years. And during that time period, I wound up breaking my ties with Warren Goetz and going on my own with this other gentleman whose name was Vern Conkle. And my job for Bethlehem Steel kept me very, very busy because I was responsible for the activities of electricians on three shifts, and anything and everything electrical in the quarry, the crushing plant, the electric digging machines, boat loading, and every other facility associated with the enterprise was all my responsibility. So I actually had guys working on three ships. I was responsible for everything that they did, and it kept me very busy.
You didn't get much sleep for 7 years, I would guess.
Well, actually, I had a very interesting arrangement, and it worked out quite nicely. I had a radio transmitter in my... incidentally, I moved from the cabin in the woods and rented a trailer, a very nice sized trailer, from Vern Conkle's daughter. And she had gotten married and moved away, so it was ideal. And I moved in there, and I had a transmitter and receiver set up in the bedroom. And I actually got to the point where I could leave it on and sleep through everything unless they called my number. My truck number was 71. And any time someone called it, I woke up almost immediately. It was very interesting. And so if I couldn't solve the problem on the radio, then I would drive down to the ferry dock take a ferry boat. They'd send a boat over for me, no matter what time it was. And I would take the ferry boat over to Drummond, where I had a truck parked, and drive into the plant. And this kind of activity went on for quite some time until, I don't remember what year it was, but it was sometime in the early 70s, I got wind of the fact that they were going to scrap one of the older electric shovels. And this thing had been built in 1926 and had General Electric synchronous motors in it, along with, you know, large DC generators and a bunch of other goodies. And I went to my superiors and I said, look, if you're going to scrap the shovel, that's fine. But let me take the MG set out of it and the high voltage switch gear and salvage it and rebuild it, and I'll turn it into something which will save you guys a lot of money. And I think they were very, very skeptical about this, to be honest with you, Don, but they said as long as I did it in my spare time, they wouldn't care. And it took me 3 years working overtime, which I didn't care about, you know, because I had nothing else to do with my time. And basically what I did was I built them a large synchronous capacitor with a capacity of about 800,000 vars. And let me tell you what that means in plain English. A synchronous capacitor is essentially a synchronous motor that's not turning a load, but it's left running. And it has electronic controls associated with it, which change the intensity of its magnetic field. And by doing this in the proper manner, you can suddenly make the machine look like a gigantic capacitor, and you can literally take current out of it. And the reason I built it was because they were incurring these enormous bills from the power company due to the amount of power that it took them to start various pieces of machinery, particularly the huge mile-long conveyor belt that brought crushed stone down to the boat loading facility. And when they had to stop that thing with a load on it, it just took an enormous amount of power to start it. And, of course, in an industrial environment, power is billed not just for the kilowatts that you use, but also for the demand that you incur when you start various pieces of equipment. And they will use the demand as a multiplier for your electric bill. And one enormous start of a device like that can literally triple the amount of payment that you owe them in a month's time, because they use it to modify the bill for the entire month. And so with my facility, what I was able to do was to supply the starting current from this synchronous capacitor instead of pulling it from the utility. And the savings was astronomical. And the power company actually came over and tested all their equipment because they thought we had bypassed the meters. But naturally, we hadn't. And the reason that this is significant, Don, is because in this device wound up being the seeds of the Dynaflux alternator invention, although I didn't realize it at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, you know, when you consider factories that are in, let's say, residential areas or on the outskirts of residential areas, and they have equipment that they use intermittently, and they fire these big motors up or these conveyor belts or lifts and use the kind of power that you're talking about, there's a surge or there's a drain on the line that is going out, you know, throughout the community. When it's the power company, what happens when they're firing that up? Is it the same situation, or do they have a way to prevent that from happening? Because I would think you know, there would be a drop in the amount of power available as they're trying to get this thing up to speed from a dead stop.
Well, there is, but the power company looks upon it as a boon to them, because their argument is that if you pull 1,000 amps starting some huge motor that has a load on it, but you normally don't pull that much current to start something. Let's just say it happens once in a blue moon.
Yeah.
Their argument is that if they didn't supply you the amperage and the reactive power to allow you to start that thing, that you couldn't run at all. And so their policy is that they have to have the capacity always standing by to allow you to do a thing like that. And so they feel that they should be compensated just for having the capacity to supply you with that power, even if it is intermittent.
Yeah,
and so this is where the idea of demand came into the picture.
Uh-huh.
If you demand a huge startup surge from the power company, the way they compensate themselves for that is that they use that demand measurement as a multiplier, and they multiply that. Every area has a different formula, but basically they multiply that times your normal KW load and use it to jack up the price considerably. And they use the highest demand rating for the month to modify your entire bill for the month.
Yeah, if I didn't know better, I would bet they learned that technique from the petroleum industry. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I don't know too much about the petroleum industry, but they're
pricing.
Certainly making profits nowadays.
Oh yeah, as far as pricing, and you know what, the pharmaceutical companies learned that too from them. Now I'm wondering if they learned it from the power company or the petroleum industry, but. Anyway, I'm just ranting here. you're speaking about something though that really justifies a cost if they have to be able to handle that extra load is what you're saying. And so you
were
able to.
That's their argument, and I guess that it's at this point it's grandfathered into the situation. So you know,
yeah.
It's not going to be changed, but that's okay. What I was doing essentially was I was supplying a negative spike, you might say, or a negative demand, which was equal and opposite to the demand that they would have seen. And so as a result of that, my equipment started just fine, but the meters would show just a tiny little bump as opposed to a big spike. And so the demand ratings came down to the point where they just couldn't believe the difference in the bill that they were allowed to submit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during the time when I was playing with this facility that I began to realize the importance of negative power as opposed to positive power, and the fact that under certain conditions, you can have an interplay between positive and negative power. And it was only at that point that I really understood what Tesla meant when he started talking about power oscillations as opposed to current oscillations. And there's an enormous difference between the two, Don. There really is.
Mm-hmm. So now you're saving them all this money. Did you get a raise for this, or you know, did they acknowledge this, or they said, well, you get to keep your job? In other words,
they acknowledged it. You know, I got a nice pat on the back. I didn't get any raise that I remember, but actually, I didn't care because I was in seventh heaven. I mean, if you ever saw this facility, and I think I sent you pictures of it at one point.
I have the pictures.
This was quite a considerable size building, and, you know, they had built it at their expense. I, of course, had designed everything, including the building, the engine bed, you know, the controls, the high voltage system, the transformer yard, everything. But the beautiful thing about it was that what I learned from doing all of this is really what I felt was my compensation. I wasn't worried about a raise. Heck, I was making good money anyway. But come out of it, which was a surprise, was that the once the power company realized that I had done this, they started asking me if I would be interested in consulting for them. And I actually solved some interesting problems for them over at their generating station in Detour. And that's when I met the young man that helped me with the famous experiment that I told you about, which led to the inspirations I got on Dynaflux.
Oh, yes. Now, as we speak, I'm glad you reminded me of these photos. This week, I'm going to post these photos on my website at directlightproductions.com and may get some of these over onto my Evident Footprints page on BBS Radio as well, so that the listeners can go to either site and take a look at these pictures. These are incredible when you see the work that this man did. These are huge pieces of equipment. You know, this is not something that you put in your pocket or in your lunchbox, you know.
I don't think so.
And I promise you, I'll do that. I still have them. I've got them on my screen right now, and they're amazing. The color is really good for that time. And I might try to enhance these a little bit, but it looks like you took them with a pretty decent camera.
I always loved taking pictures of the things I was involved with, so I think I used a 35mm on that, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, there's one picture of a lift that looks like it's carrying a roof. By any chance, was that the roof to the house or the cabin you built? Did you move it over
there?
Oh,
no. That was the roof to the facility itself. I designed it to come off because that was the only way that you could put the machinery in there.
I see.
So if you notice, there's another picture somewhere that shows them lowering the generators and the switchgear down into the facility.
Next picture, and that guy better move out of the way, or they're going to drop it right on his feet. Okay, it looks like it's huge. I mean, this thing is huge. My goodness.
Well, I tell you what, I could literally rock the stability of the government generating station in Sault Ste. Marie, the hydro station at the locks in Sault Ste. Marie, which was like 60-some-odd miles away, 60, 70 miles away. I could get on the phone and talk to the engineer up there and ask him to look at his power meters. And by changing the excitation value in my equipment, I could literally send power all the way to Sault Ste. Marie from Drummond Island with that machine. So it was very powerful.
There is a story, and I think, would it be appropriate for you to tell that story right now? And that's the one with the incoming storm and the project you were working on and how you had to have these conditions, you know, to fire it up. It is
a
great story.
That's a good story. Of course, there might be some things I leave out, but nonetheless, that's a good story, and it's a good position to end at this evening because, you know, what follows actually starts to get into the work that I'm doing today. But let me just tell you that at this point in time, I was extremely interested in setting up conditions that would cause power to oscillate. And as a result of the consulting work that I had been doing for the local power company, I met the guy who was the operator at the peaking plant across the river in Detour, and we became good friends quite quickly. And I studied the two machines that they had in his facility, and they were Fairbanks Morse post piston diesels driving two 5,000 horsepower generators. And I right away realized that the capacity of his station and my station were close enough that under the right conditions, I could set up an oscillation if he cooperated with me. The problem is that they would have to be the only two things on the system. And so I questioned him about this, and he said, well, you know, anytime there's a wicked ice storm, he said, we open the links between Detour and Sault Ste. Marie, and the Detour engines are put online, and they hold the load of Detour and the quarry on Drummond. And he said, under those conditions, your equipment and my equipment would be the only two things on the line. So I said to him, listen, this is really exciting. And I told him, gave him an outline of what I expected might happen and what we could learn from it. And so he went along with it on the idea. And I forget exactly how many weeks it was later, but just before the holidays, he gave me a call one night and told me that the Weather Bureau had contacted him, and there was a wicked ice storm coming down from Canada, and they intended to open the links. And so he was already online when he called me, and I was so excited. I took the ferry boat over to Drummond and waited for his call in my little generating station over there. And meantime, what I did was I switched the polarity on my regulators so that they would do just the opposite of what they normally did. In other words, instead of squelching the amount of power that it took from the source, I had reversed the situation so that they would augment the power cyclically. But in order to make the idea work, I had to change the operating frequency from 60 cycles. And so I brought with me a variable frequency oscillator and hooked that into the regulator, which was equipped to take calibration signals from an outside source. And when we went online together, I told my friend John that I would be slowly turning up the frequency and that he should report to me what was happening in the generating plant. And that way I'd be able to find the resonant frequency of this type of resonance that I was trying to promote. And so you have to picture this, Don. This is in the middle of the night.
I'm picturing it, yeah.
And you know, it's about 11 o'clock at night, and a wicked storm is upon the town. All the Christmas decorations are up. Everybody is watching TV, or else they're in the bar listening to jukeboxes and stuff like that. And here's these two mad scientists playing around with the electrical power for the whole area. And as I slowly brought the frequency up, naturally a beat began to be imposed on the line between what my machine was producing and what the generators were producing. And all hell broke loose in this town. I mean, the jukeboxes either speeded up so that everybody thought they were listening to a chorus of mice, or else it slowed way down. People's hair dryers burned out, all the Christmas bulbs were exploding. And, of course, I wasn't aware of any of this because I was, you know, across the river in my facility over there, and John was in the generating station, but we certainly found out about it later on. And to make a long story short, when I hit a certain frequency with respect to the line frequency, all of a sudden everything went dead quiet, and the engines had no load on it. And, of course, this is exactly the phenomenon that I was looking for. And even though the engines had hardly any load on it, all of the normal load was still being lit. So you had the houses all had light, the quarry was still operating, and everything was appearing to be normal, except that his meters showed as if there was hardly any load on the line. And this is the result of true energy resonance. And it was while I was pondering the results of this that I eventually had the inspiration for the Dynaflux alternator. But that experiment blew the minds of the people in that town because they didn't know what was going on. And what eventually happened was that the power level built to such an extent that I blew the cable heads right off the river crossing. And the fireball was so enormous that it lit the whole town up. And everybody assumed that the cable was struck by lightning, which, of course, I was happy to acknowledge. And that in itself ended the experiment, but not before I got critical information that I used later on in my research.
Now, the next day is the part that I want you to describe to the listeners before we close the show.
When Vroom came into the shop?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember, the next morning...
I had asked, there had to be some kind of anomalies happening with people's lighting and their radios and their TVs that, you're dealing with a situation that's going to affect these household appliances in a very strange way.
Oh, yeah, it definitely did. And I was in the little shop the next morning early, and in comes my partner, Vern, and... He was in a very peculiar mood, and he says to me, that was quite a storm we had last night, wasn't it? And I said, yeah, I said, really quite powerful. And he said, strange stuff, that lightning, isn't it? And I said, yeah, I guess so. I said, what are you alluding to? And he said, well, he said, I was watching the news last night, and he said, I was astonished to see Walter Cronkite shrink down to the size of a postage stamp and then expand to the point where his nose filled the entire screen. And, of course, I burst out laughing, and he looked at me and he said, what the heck were you trying to accomplish last night? And he knew it was me all along.
I laughed. Folks, the last time Jim told this story on my show when I was on another network, and this was months ago, I laughed for, 15 minutes? I got giddy, and I couldn't stop laughing. So I'm glad he's telling this at the end. I can laugh off the air. But it's hilarious to imagine that.
I tell you what, it was even funnier to live there and hear all of the comments in the coffee clutches about the shenanigans that went on. And, of course, I had to be as surprised as the next guy, because otherwise they would have tarred and feathered me.
Oh, what a story, though. Well, Jim, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for coming on. We're going to have you back again, I'm sure, next week. We've got more to cover on this. And folks, we're leading to a very interesting invention that Jim developed. And even trying to get it out on the market is an interesting story. So you're going to want to make sure you keep your eyes on our schedule. And as soon as I know Jim's coming on board, I'll have it posted. But we're trying to give him the last show of at the end of the week, so he can catch up on his sleep and not have to stay up late at night, because he gets up really early in the morning and carries on all these crazy experiments like the one he just described. So he needs as much rest as he can get. Jim knows I'm only kidding. But Jim, thank you so much for being on the show. And you sound really good tonight. People are still sending me email and calling me up asking how you're doing, and I'm telling them you're doing fine. Listen to the show tonight. He's going to be on the air. So, you know, we thank God and all the people that prayed for your speedy recovery, and what can I say? God is good, and God brings that about. So I'd like to have you back again, and you are not going to tell me no, are you?
No, you know I'll be back. I enjoy it very much.
Okay. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints here on BBSRadio.com. Tomorrow evening, I have a special guest, someone that's not been on my show before, but she's a good friend, an activist in the Patriot Movement and the causes that are affecting more and more people across the country, those who are speaking out against the criminal activity going on in government and the Justice Department. Marianne Ponder is going to be our special guest, and we're going to talk about a number of issues. She's a regular person like the rest of us, and you're going to want to hear what she has to say. So please make it a point to listen to the show. In the meantime, I'd like to thank Don Newsom and Seth for doing such a great job with the audio, helping me out with my webpage. Visit directlightproductions.com, keep up with the news. And we're going to be doing some really great things with bbsradio.com. You're going to want to keep an eye on the website there. I'm also going to be doing a new show this Wednesday. I know it's going to be in the afternoon, and I think it's going to be 1 o'clock Pacific time, if I'm correct. And I'm going to do read some news items that you folks send in to our news page, and I'm going to do some commentary on that. So you're going to want to catch that show this Wednesday. Of course, I'm here Monday through Friday, and I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow. In the meantime, peace, love, and light. God bless America, and everyone sleep tight. Good night.